Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Welcome to Deconstructive Criticism. I'm Aaron Flam, and today we navigate the complexities of military strategy and international diplomacy with Professor Ephraim Inbar. Our discussion spans the intricacies of Israel's engagements in Gaza, the rationale behind preemptive strikes on Hezbollah, and strategies for resilience in volatile geopolitical climates. Our deepest thanks are extended to the remarkable individuals whose financial support has facilitated this series. Should you feel moved by our content and wish to contribute, please consider joining our community of patrons at patreon.com/AaronFlam. For listeners in Sweden, contributions can be made via Swish at 0768943737. We are honored to have Professor Ephraim Inbar, esteemed president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security, with us today. Professor Inbar, a renowned academic figure, brings a wealth of experience from his tenure at Shalem College, as well as his foundational role at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies. His scholarly journey has included roles at preeminent institutions worldwide and participation in pivotal security and educational committees within Israel. With an impressive bibliography and a profound understanding of security policy, Israeli-Palestinian relations, and the dynamics of the Middle East, Professor Inbar offers us invaluable insights today. With credentials grounded in rigorous academic pursuit, including an MA and PhD from the University of Chicago and a foundation in political science and English literature at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Professor Inbar's perspectives are rooted in a deep analysis and a dedication to factual accuracy. Enjoy.
So, Professor Inbar, president of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security, founder of the Begin Sadat Center, you've written several books, five if I'm not mistaken, hundreds of scholarly articles. Welcome to Deconstructive Criticism.
My pleasure.
So may I start with, I hope your family is safe. I'd like to say that in the beginning.
And my son returned last week from Gaza after a long service. So we are feeling much better.
I'm grateful and for his service. Even as a Jew in the diaspora, it's quite important that Israel keeps existing. What I wanted to know as a start-off question is, I watched a lecture of yours from 9 years ago after the 2014 Gaza War, Protective Edge. Have your perspective on the situation changed since October 7?
I don't remember what I said at the time, I must say, but generally I didn't change my views radically over time. So I still hold on to the same position.
Well, Israel at that time had a mow the lawn sort of strategy, yeah, where you cut down the grass as it grows, so to speak, and You said it was unrealistic to leave, to eradicate Hamas, even maybe demilitarize Hamas. And now you have changed your mind?
No, I did not. I think that we still have no possibility to eradicate Hamas. Hamas is a radical Islamist movement with deep roots in Palestinian society. Many Palestinians support Hamas, and now after October 7, we see even greater support for Hamas. They are the heroes that were successful in attacking Israel, occupying part of its territory, torturing Israelis, raping Israelis. So they look well in the eyes of the Palestinians. And therefore, I don't think we can eradicate them. But what we can do, and this is what we are trying to do, basically to terminate to their military capabilities. And probably after a while, they'll grow the grass a little bit again. And then we'll have to mow the grass again. I think our mistake was that we didn't mow the grass short enough in the past years.
You didn't do enough. That's the problem.
Right. I think we did not do enough in terms of destroying their infrastructure, in destroying their units, in inflicting pain on Hamas. We gave them time for a tremendous build-up, military build-up. And also, by it not exercising our military muscle enough, we eroded our deterrence.
Deterrence is a very important word. Can you explain why it is so important? I come from Schwedia. We are used to be a neutral country. We're just applying to NATO now.
Well, I think there is a change in Sweden, a drastic change, you know, to give up neutrality. Because they also believe that there are bad guys in the neighborhood and they might be attacked.
Yes.
In our case, we don't need a Russian invasion of Ukraine to realize that our neighborhood is a tough neighborhood in which our existence depends on deterring our enemies. Otherwise, they will be at our throats all the time. And we have actually sometimes in which they do not attack us, and this is because of our deterrence.
And that was eroded on October 7th.
Definitely. It's not only that, not only Hamas, the mere fact that Hezbollah joined the fray is a clear proof that Hezbollah was also not deterred, and they started the war.
Even the Houthis joined in.
Yeah, they are far away, so yeah. They are less afraid of Israel, but Hezbollah is just beyond the border.
It is interesting that you bring up Hezbollah, because as it stands now, only Rafah is still... only the Rafah exists in the south of Gaza. I'm guessing the Israeli army will take care of Rafah, and then is Hezbollah next?
Well, hopefully we'll have the time, the political clock will allow us to deal Hamas in Gaza a defeat, as we've done in other places in Gaza. And then hopefully we'll be able to take Hezbollah. Hezbollah will probably be more difficult because of greater international constraints. The Hamas attack was a clear violation of good taste and of everything, and Hezbollah in this respect is more cautious. It's a limited war, and the Americans, which are an important player in the equation, do not want an escalation.
Why don't they want an escalation? Wouldn't it be good for them if Israel was allowed to eliminate another Iranian proxy?
It would be very good, in my opinion, probably in your opinion, but it's not the opinion of the Biden administration. They basically are fearful of an escalation that might bring them into a situation in which they may have a conflict with Iran. They are dreadful of such a situation. And you this think- is why they sent immediately after the war started in Gaza, their ships to the region. They said quite clearly, we don't want an escalation.
Yes, but it doesn't seem to matter to Iran. Iran's proxies are still attacking American ships and American bases with casualties. And the Biden administration's response so far has been quite weak, wouldn't you say?
I agree. The Iranians are smart. They are playing the game very well. They use their proxies. They were very successful in establishing in several countries Iranian proxies, which do their dirty job, allowing them some space of denial. It's not me, it's the other guy.
Yeah.
And they understand that particularly this administration is happy to play along and not to get involved with Iran. To some extent, I understand the Americans. Their plate is full. They have a war in Ukraine. They have a war in Gaza. They need to prepare for the Chinese challenge in the Indo-Pacific. So they read the political map very well and poke in the eye of the Americans all the time.
It's an interesting terminology to call the Chinese threat a challenge. But do you see a connection between Iran and China and Russia that really threatens the world order as it stands now?
I think you must be blind not to see it. They are together. The Iranians provide arms to the Russians. The Russians are happy with the Iranian role. They host I think yesterday, a summit of all their proxies in Moscow. The Chinese signed agreements with Iran. They hold naval exercises together. It is clear anti-American axis. And the Americans, for some reason, prefer not to see it.
Do you think it's lack of confidence on the United States part?
I think, first of all, they realize that the American public is tired with wars far away. They had two great setbacks or defeats in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they prefer not to engage in additional military adventures. But it's a very myopic view, of course, because if you don't react strongly to provocations from your enemies, you seem weak. And I think this is a perception of the United States in the Middle East. The Middle East is a very real political world, and all leaders think in such terms, and they see a weak America. And it's a pity because we need a strong America.
So what would happen if Pax Americana fell? Personally, I think it might have fallen, but...
The Americans still have a lot of clout in this region, and they need, to some extent, this region because they want their allies to be supplied with energy, which comes from the Middle East. Their allies in Europe, their allies in Asia, you know, Korea, Japan, of course, Taiwan. So it is a situation in which the liberal lens of this administration are leading them into very wrong policy.
I think you're right. Turning back to Israel, you think you didn't apply the... Well, let's not call it mow the lawn. Let's call it a strategy of attrition, because that's what it is, yeah. Right? A long war of attrition against Israel's enemies. Is that supposed to continue the day after Gaza is defeated?
Did the Palestinians change?
I don't know. Once I heard you say that some things are learned just through long processes of suffering.
I agree. I think that... we have to inflict much more pain upon the Palestinian society in order to change. But I must say, and I say it even with appreciation, that the ability of the Palestinian body politic and people to sustain pain is great, and unbelievably great. They were beaten once more, and still they believe that eventually will not survive.
You have the clocks, they have the time.
It's going to be a long conflict, and I think anybody that thinks that peace is around the corner is mistaken and is nourishing dangerous illusions. I want to tell you a story.
Yes.
I was gave a talk at a Greek think tank, and one of the audience, an academic, a woman, told me, listen, you fight already the Palestinians 100 years. Enough is enough. How much? No. So I asked her, how many years did you fight the Turks? I knew the answer. And she said, 400 years. So I said, no, if this is true, and I knew it was true, we are a young conflict. Only 100 years.
Okay, so that's how you see it. So
I think this is a prism you should take in order to understand the dynamics of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
You should take the long view.
A very long view. And if you want, you know, to look at it comparatively, you know, if we take a look what society has really changed dramatically in the 20th century, it's Germany and Japan. Germany lost two world wars and many millions of people. Japan suffered an atomic attack. And
two, actually.
Yeah, okay. One atomic attack with two bombs. But this was not enough. They changed their education system. And they changed their education system because there were leaders within those countries that were willing to initiate and legitimize this educational change. With the Palestinians, in the Palestinian case, maybe we see a lot of suffering, but we don't see any leaders that are really ready to say what we have taught our children is terrible. We have to change our curriculum.
I heard the same argument of de-radicalization when I interviewed Mr. Alon Levy the other day. He said that has to change, and it worked in Germany, and it worked in Japan. And I didn't counter-argue, but my counter-argument would have been that Germany was a very civilized country before Hitler took power. They were highly developed. They had democratic institutions. There was there was an inheritance of democracy within the German populace. And Japan might not have been democratic, but it was a highly developed society. So there's a difference, no, between the Gazans and the Japanese and the Germans.
Well, I agree. This is why I think that the Palestinians have a much longer way to go than the Germans and the Japanese. Indeed, you are completely right. The level of political development within the Palestinian society is much lower than it was in Germany or in Japan, which actually protracts the conflict.
So what will happen the day after you defeat Hamas?
Not much different. Basically, we'll see a situation like in Judea and Samaria, where there may be some pro forma government, you know, be it Palestinian. I don't know what will happen there. You know, if it's a Palestinian Authority or some kind of international regime, and Hamas will try to reestablish itself, and the Israeli reaction will be military. Will simply conduct raids in order to debilitate their military capabilities, like we do in the West Bank.
You think the Palestinians might have the taste for a prolonged struggle, a few more hundred years, 300 more years. But what about the Israeli society? How long do you think a comfortable, highly developed, high technological society can stand sending their kids into war?
This is obviously a key question. But actually, I'm quite encouraged by what happened during this war.
How so?
On October 6, one day before the attack, Israeli society was very divided. And the level of hatred was extremely high. You know, it was a very difficult period in Israel for people that tried to say things in a more moderate way, you know, to have a civilized argument with the other side. Okay, we don't have to agree on everything, but we are not the enemy of the nation, or they are not the enemy of the nation. And it changed. The war started, and we are all united. There is great social cohesion. The level of volunteering by the civil society is incredible. We do things without the government. For many things, we don't need a government.
Yeah.
Just stay away and we'll do the job.
You turned out to all be libertarians in a certain way.
In many ways, despite socialist tradition we had. So this is good news. So, which, and of course, the people that went to fight, the reservists, the over 100% of the units reported to duty, which means that people that were already released from duty decided to join their former units. And it's not easy to be in Gaza as a soldier. You know, from the experience of my son, you can't change even the socks in your shoes for a long period of time.
Because, yes. Yeah, I doubt that's the most horrible, but...
You don't have any place to shower. So it's hard life as a soldier. I was a combat soldier once. I know how it is. It's not only the danger of getting killed, but the conditions of the battle are very difficult. And we see, they go. Not only that, when they leave, they get an order to report in a few months again, and I'm sure they will.
So all it took for a very fragmented Israeli society to come together was a huge crisis and over 1,000 dead in the most horrific ways.
It's wrong to see the Israeli society as divided or fragmented.
Why?
I think there is much more consensus than people think. I'll give you example on several issues. Obviously, the Sephardi Ashkenazi divide is no longer relevant, you know. Maybe in the Haredi or ultra-Orthodox community. But, you know, my students at the university couldn't care less, you know, who was who, you know, what kind of family you came from. So there is also what we call intermarriage, you know, not the European sense or the American sense of intermarriage. Every one in a third marriage is between Ashkenazi and Sephardi. If we take a look at economic issues, once there were great divisions of opinion between capitalists and socialists. By now, we all are good capitalists. You know, there are here and there some remnants of, you know, socialist ideology and, you know, people that didn't grow up. But, you know, most of society is happy with a capitalist system, a benign capitalist system. And I think there's no longer issue of dispute. Even about the territories.
You mean what you would call Judea or Samaria?
No, I'm talking about the Golan Heights, for example, or Gaza, or Sinai. On Golan, there is a huge amount of support for staying there. That's it. In Gaza, there was a great disagreement about whether we should unilaterally leave Gaza or not. But now, most people, the instinct of most Israelis is stay out of Gaza. And this is what this government said from the very beginning. We have no intention of staying in Gaza. And despite the voices that say, no, we should resettle in Gaza, but this is not part of the government, and this is a right-wing government, not part of the right-wing government platform. And in Judea and Samaria, I think most Israelis are ready for a territorial compromise, meaning that in case there will be a partner, we are ready to make territorial concessions. Not in Jerusalem, not in the Jordan Valley, but in other areas, that's fine. But there is also great consensus that there is no partner.
Yes.
So what are we fighting for? You know, we fought over basically the power of the Supreme Court of Justice, which is not, you know, in my view, not such a very important issue. After all, and I'm in favor of reforming, of curtailing the power of the Supreme Court of Justice. After all, the government gave up the reform. For all practical reasons, they may say things, but for all practical reasons, I understood that some people in the country, maybe they don't understand the issue, it doesn't matter why, they are very much opposed to how the reform was proposed. And basically, Netanyahu gave it up. This is also not part of his real concern. He's concerned on another thing. Actually, the crisis was a result of his neglect. He neglected the issue. He allowed other people to deal with it, and it was mismanaged, the whole thing. So I don't think that there are many issues that are of great dispute. Of course, there is one important issue, is religion. The divide between the religious and the non-religious. But this is not a real dichotomy. It's a continuum. We have the real religious secularists. We have the religious, the moderate religious, the religious Zionists, and we have the ultra-Orthodox in the middle. We have a lot of what we call traditionalists, which go in the Shabbat morning, they go to the synagogue, and they, in the afternoon, they go and they see a soccer match, a football match. So, and even among the ultra-Orthodox, we see now what we call a new phenomenon of light ultra-Orthodox. People that go and work and send their kids to ultra-Orthodox schools. But in some of the ultra-Orthodox schools, there is already secular studies. So we have this phenomenon. It's not widespread, but I think it's the beginning of a slow, very slow, too slow in my view, change in the ultra-Orthodox community. So I think it's this view of a divided Israeli society, different tribes, as the president said, it's a wrong view.
Hellenistic Jews against Bar Kokhba. No?
Bar Kokhba was not Hellenistic.
No, he wasn't. They were fighting each other.
No. Bar Kokhba didn't. He fought the Romans.
That too.
The Maccabees fought the Hellenistic Jews.
Okay.
We have Hellenistic Jews. Maybe reform movement, we can see it such a way. But they were not, the reform is not in power, nothing. Like the Hellenists. The Hellenists try to shove their beliefs through the throat of the others.
So Israel is more solidified than it has been in a long time now.
Oh, definitely.
Do you think after Gaza, is it time to deal with Hezbollah now?
Listen, I advocated a preemptive strike against Hezbollah some time ago.
Yes, I know you did.
So
you're still on that position.
Of course, if now it's not a preemptive strike. You know, they started the war; they should pay for it. We have to bring back over 100,000 settlers along the northern border. If we don't win the war against Hezbollah, they will not go back. We cannot allow the situation that is currently, you know, the status quo of today to continue there. We have to take care of the Hezbollah threat.
And how will this be done?
By force.
Air raids, ground forces?
You have to include a ground force, a ground invasion. And I think one thing that became clear during this war, that the notion that a big war will not come, will not be in this region again, are wrong. There are some people in the IDF that saw it that way. Also, the notion that, which was America important, that through good intelligence and air power, you can win a war. It ain't so. You have to fight the war the old way.
American Britain has now said that they might unilaterally acknowledge a Palestinian state. Do you think that will change the situation?
No. First of all, many countries recognize a Palestinian
Sweden
state.
Is one of them.
No, already in 1988.
Who?
I don't remember, but those countries, you know, particularly third world countries, recognize, they declared the state. And so they'll declare again. What counts is facts on the ground.
You mean
they can call themselves whatever they want, but they cannot establish a state, and I'll tell you why.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The main criteria for a state, for a political unity to be called a state, according to political scientists, political sociologists, Max Weber, for example, is monopoly over use of force. A country in Sweden, there are no militias, right?
That used to be true. Now we have gangster wars in the streets. But...
Yeah, but this is a problem for the state, so but it can be, it should be overcome. The Palestinians established, were given a state, basically, by Rabin and the Oslo. And don't forget, his requirements from the Palestinians was no Supreme Court and no human rights organization. If you got that, you can fight terrorism. This was Rabin's explicit words. And they failed. You know, they one militia, Hamas took over Gaza. And not even in Gaza, there is monopoly over use of force because you have there another militia, the Palestinian Jihad. And in the West Bank, basically the PA lost control. And you have militias in several refugee camps which don't listen to what's said in Ramallah. And I must say that this is not only a Palestinian problem. If we take a look at the Arab world, we have similar situations in Iraq, in Syria. There are militias there. In Sudan, in Yemen, they have a problem.
Yes, and a lot of these militias are funded by Iran.
It doesn't matter. A state should control its territory and have monopoly of its force.
I was just thinking that Hamas is an Iranian proxy, Hezbollah is an Iranian proxy, and why attack those and not go for the head of the snake?
Oh, I'm ready.
Oh, really? You think Israel should preemptively attack Iran?
I think it's very difficult. You know, it's a strong state, it's a large state, but we should take care again of the military capabilities, particularly the nuclear installations. And again, I'm on the record since 2005 that we should take out the critical nuclear installations in Iran. And nobody else is going to do that for us. It's an illusion that Americans will do something about it.
But why? I mean, it should be in America's interest. It should be, shouldn't it? To preserve Pax Americana all over the world. Ensure the safety of the sea lanes. Freedom of the skies, no?
I fully agree with you, but what we think it's common wisdom, it's not necessarily the common wisdom in a democratic administration in Washington.
Do you think there will be a change if Trump wins the election?
Frankly, I'm not sure. Because when Trump was president, the Iranians destroyed half of the Saudi capability to produce oil. For quite a while, and Trump didn't do anything about it. Trump, maybe one exception, killing Soleimani, didn't touch the Iranians.
But killing Soleimani is sort of a signal, isn't it? It's more than Biden has done.
Well, Biden has done a few things also, but signals are not enough. You know, you have to follow the signals if the signals are not convincing enough. And I don't think that the Iranians took seriously those signals, and they think that America is a paper tiger. And to some extent, they are right. Their political analysis seems to be more correct than the American one.
I just don't understand how that can be. It's still the greatest military in the world, the biggest.
Yes, but you need political leadership. America is a democracy, and the military there needs an order to do something by the political leadership.
So what happens after Israel preemptively, or not preemptively because Hezbollah started the war, but let's say they defeat Hezbollah. Will Israel have to stay in southern Lebanon?
Not necessarily. You know, we learned that staying there is costly. And also very problematic politically at home. So we should adopt, you know, strategic raids. You know, go in, kill a few bad guys, destroy as much as we can, go home, and after a while do it again. This is our destiny here.
For another 300 years, apparently, at least.
So, that's what we have to do.
Why don't the world like the Jews?
It's a very difficult question, but it is quite clear that at least for the last 2,000 years, we are not a very liked nation. I suffered anti-Semitism when I was a child in Europe.
You was born in Bucharest, Romania.
Yeah, right. I was called Dirty Jew. And I beat them back. And it's a question I'm not sure I have an authoritative answer. You know, it's we are not popular. I think that people now, when they face a new wave of anti-Semitism, and how can they be so? But we were lucky to have a short period in our history after the Holocaust, when there was some time of, they pitied us, you know, it was a lot of this element. But it's over, you know, the Holocaust impact is evaporating, and people are back. It's a cultural thing. We killed God. we killed their God. And I remember I was in the United States in the South once. I came out of a supermarket and the small black boy, maybe 8 years, 9 years, looked at me. I wore a yarmulke, obviously he understood I was a Jew. And he asked me, why did you kill God? And I looked at him, I said, do I look like a killer? He said, no. So we went, each one of them went its way, but obviously he heard it at home or somewhere in his
Well,
he
should
church.
Have told them it wasn't me, it was the Italians. And they just blamed the Jews.
I don't think he would be convinced. It is so ingrained in the European culture. And to some extent it's different, of course, in non-biblical, you know, cultures in India, China, although we see signs of anti-Semitism in China nowadays, yes, which is probably politically more political motivated rather than cultural.
I was in China many years ago, over a decade, and my local guide pointed out books in the bookstore and said, these are about Jews. And I asked, so what do they say? Well, they're self-help books. This is how the Jews took over the world. You can do it too. Baron Rothschild, this is how he conquered everything. So they still had some anti-Semitic notions, but they saw them as positive things, and now it has changed.
In those areas, I think there is great admiration of the Jewish people. In China, in India, in Japan. Maybe it was a grain of envy. But of course, you know, in India, obviously, not many know how many we are. So
they are quite numerous themselves.
Yeah, but when we tell them we are 8 million here, you know, do we make so much noise? It is, they don't believe it. They don't believe it. We have to adjust to it. That's part of our life. And I think Herzl was wrong, you know, to establish a Jewish state will normalize the state of the Jews. In some ways it did, but we did not get rid of anti-Semitism. This is too much ingrained.
Maybe By it's too way, early I'm, to tell if Herzl it was wrong.
Well, 2,000 years is a long period. Maybe it will change. My institute doesn't deal with anti-Semitism.
I know, but I wanted to ask you because from lectures I've seen, you tend to mention it.
Because I think that anti-Semitism is a disease of the Gentile world. It's not our job to cure the Gentile world. We are too small, too weak to heal the whole world. It's their job to do it. If they want to heal themselves of this terrible disease, they should invest money into their education system. And Jews should not put even one penny into this. I know I'm not very popular by saying it, but...
You're talking to a Jew who's actually written a book about anti-Semitism for Gentiles. So, but I did make some money from it too. So
okay, then it's okay.
So yeah. So, but what if America and the West falls? What happens then? Can Israel stand alone? I mean, Israel defines itself in its national character as a Western country, believes in democracy, freedom of women, freedom of LGBTQIA people?
First of all, we are a small state, and it's always possible that Jews will make enough mistakes to destroy their state. We have, obviously, we've seen, particularly pre-October 7, destructive feelings, destructive deeds by Jews in Israel. This is a possibility. But there are not too many nations that were able to survive the destruction of their state. go into exile and survive. We are the best example of surviving without a state.
I think one of the few, if not the only, who got their state back.
Right. I'll stay here.
You'll stay here?
Yeah, I'm staying here, but if anybody goes into exile, I think there is enough Jewish ammunition, cultural, religious, to continue the peoplehood, not without difficulties. Actually, we lost the state twice in our history, and we are back.
Yes, for the time being. But so disregarding Jewish mistakes, let's say every Jew in Israel does everything right, as well as every Israeli, Arab, Druze, Baha'i, whomever, Bedouin, without a patron like the United States, which is a patron of Israel. After all, you can't deny that. Will Israel stand alone? Because coming from Western Europe, I'll tell you, they don't seem to be waking up and finding their national spirit anytime soon.
I don't know how the international system will develop.
No, but you are the most qualified person in this room to ask.
but I don't know the future. I live in the land of the prophets, but I'm not a prophet. So if you are smart enough, you can maneuver into a world that some people will see you as an ally, some people will see you as an enemy. Obviously, not everybody in our region sees us as an enemy. Actually, now I think most Arab countries, I don't know if most, but in our immediate region, see us as a savior against Iranian expansionism. So with America going away, this is basically the perception. So actually, in a world in which America is maybe further away than it was, we are managing. Look at the agreements that were signed during Trump times.
Abraham
Accords. They survived. And Saudi Arabia.
You think the peace process or the normalization process will continue?
So far, it was not damaged. The Saudis are saying they want to continue with normalization with some conditions, whatever, we don't have to take seriously everything the Arab leaders are saying. That's
one of the conditions is a Palestinian state.
So they have lived without a Palestinian state for so many years. Maybe they can live a few years more.
So you see it as Israel will survive, it will continue to integrate into the region, it will get to know its neighbors better, some of them at least. I mean, I don't see Syria and Lebanon queuing up to become friends of Israel soon.
Yeah, but the question is, will those states survive?
Good question.
So,
what do you think?
Syria and Lebanon are not a serious enemy.
Israel can bomb Syria at will without fear.
What can they do to us? They are military capabilities are very limited. Hezbollah is, of course, a large arsenal of missiles, which is very problematic. But we can deal with this situation.
At what cost? What do you think would be the cost if Hezbollah decided that it is fighting for its own existence? Nasrallah wants to survive. Will he unleash all of them? That's plus 100,000.
He may, and then the cost will be high. But what alternative do we have?
I wouldn't know, Professor. You are the expert.
We have to... We learned that we cannot allow very strong military capabilities to be sustained over time. This is what this war is all about. We have to mow the grass.
And continue to mow the grass.
Right.
Until the...
And then we'll be okay. This creates deterrence and respect in this part of the world. The use of force is part and parcel of the rules of the game, and it has great legitimacy.
Yes, it seems to be the only currency they buy, actually.
Right.
So, deterrence, though.
Yeah, deterrence, fear. Deterrence is fear. Fear is the best political currency in the Middle East.
It's a horrible thing to hear from a smiling old man.
maybe experienced. So, and with the right glasses, you know. Depends much on what kind of lens you have on the situation.
Yes, well,
we should entertain no illusions.
I have quite an historical lens with a comedian's tinge, sort of the situation. I think life is a comedy, if you have a very dark sense of humor.
Well, sometimes it's a tragic comedy.
Yes, sometimes it is. So, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
It was a pleasure talking to you and an honor.
And thank you, and send me a link.
Oh, I absolutely will.
Okay.
Thank you for tuning in to Deconstructive Criticism. Today's insightful exchange with Professor Ephraim Inbar has shed light on the nuances of conflict and diplomacy in a region that is both complex and critically important to global stability. To our supportive patrons and donors, we express our heartfelt gratitude. Your contributions not only enable these dialogues, but also enhance the quality of our collective understanding. If you are inclined to support this endeavor, we invite you to become a part of our Patreon community at patreon.com/AaronFlam, or for our Swedish audience to contribute via Swish at 0768-943737. I am Aaron Flam, your guide through these thought-provoking sessions. Until our next encounter, I wish you well in all the units of time to come.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.